way at the power of women to, quote, choose life. And I think we're going to keep winning the battles to keep most of the clinics and the hospitals open, keep the bombers in jail. We're going to defeat most of the legislation, most of the referendums, but the calls are too close. The votes are too close. I talk about the power to choose life because I firmly believe that the pro-choice movement is the real pro-life movement. How did they steal that label? Why are they pro-life? Why is choose life their slogan when it really describes what happens when a woman has the right and the ability to make her own moral decisions? And for those of us who are submerged in this issue every day, in our many and varied battles to preserve religious freedom, freedom of choice, and individual conscience, we know that the anti-choice movement has focused public attention on the fetus to the almost complete and total exclusion of the woman. But we are just beginning to see the effects that this has had on women. Now, let's put this in the context of our times. We live in very dangerous times now, because the American people have begun to question the nature of freedom. They have questioned the entitlement of all living beings to the basic blessings and truths and freedoms, right to food, clothing, shelter, employment, education, the pursuit of happiness, involvement in government, religious freedom, and the options and responsibilities of choice, of moral decision making. This administration has made Americans begin to wonder if affirmative action is really reverse discrimination. Americans have begun to wonder if honoring the right of people to minimum standards of living promotes dependency, if that creates crime or breaks our will to participate responsibly in social life. You see the paradox there? The question continues to flourish as to whether or not a woman's right and ability to make her own decisions about her own body and her own ability to bear and care for children, which is of course the most intensely personal decision she will ever make, is really a decision to commit murder. We know that the women who visit bogus clinics, even though they are outraged by their treatment there, are vulnerable to feelings of induced guilt. The anti-choice rhetoric that abortion is the murder of an innocent human being is also taking a certain toll. It inflicts pain, grieving, guilt among women. It can turn honest self-doubt and grief for a very real loss into destructive anger and self-hate. And where the rhetoric takes hold, it creates an atmosphere which completely halts reasonable discourse, informed decision-making, and in positive, empowering legislative actions. In an atmosphere such as this, women lose the power to choose life because they internalize an anti-choice message that does not promote life, but promotes death. The anti-choice movement, I believe, provokes a death of the spirit, a death of the will, and women who are trapped in self-loathing experience a death of conscience and a paralysis of action. It disempowers women. It reverses the opportunity and the challenge of empowerment, which the civil rights and the women's rights movements have provided us at a great cost, all as a result of the big lie. So what's the big lie? That's the theory that if you say something often enough and connect it with a real feeling, people will begin to believe it, even when they know in their hearts that it's not true. We see the technique used in the assertion that abortion is the American Holocaust. The anti-choice forces capitalize on the revulsion and the guilt in society for the brutality and inhumanity of the Holocaust to build a foundation of guilt. The things that I'm talking about here, if you stay to see the movie or if you see it another time, are all going to be shown to you how they're using these statements and these strategies. If the anti-choice forces wish us, who affirm a woman's right to consider the choice of legal abortion, if they want us to see ourselves reflected in the mirror of the Holocaust, I suggest that they look at themselves in that very same mirror. Because the Holocaust was the result of the ascendancy of those who would tolerate no ideological diversity, who would recognize no right to disagree with the principles and social programs of National Socialism, and who are ready to trample every noble notion of democracy and of freedom of conscience or religion beneath the brutal boot of conformity to a single system of belief. The Holocaust teaches us a critical historical lesson. Violence of language leads to violence of deed. Violence against property leads inevitably to violence against people. And all of these are classic examples, I think, of how the psychological mechanism of oppression operates, because oppression only works with the consent of the oppressed. When oppressed people quit believing that they deserve their fate, or that they cannot manage without the oppressive system that is their whole reality, when oppressed people quit revering their oppressors, then we see that the wheels of revolution are set in motion. People become empowered to fight for freedom because they believe in their fundamental right to be free and in the basic evil of those who would restrict their freedom. But the future, as the anti-choice movement would mold it, is haunted by the specter of mandatory pregnancy surrendered to willingly by women because they have abdicated their right to decide, to think, and to act on their own behalf. This is the worst case scenario. The first to fall victim to that vision of the future will be those women who presently have the fewest choices, teenagers and low-income women. Teenagers because they are still subject to the will and authority of adults and are most vulnerable, therefore, to the big lie. And low-income women because all of their decisions are subject to economic necessity. And should there be any doubt about this, the numbers, the statistics on women's lives in our so-called economic recovery in our post-Hyde Amendment days will erase all doubt. Women are getting poorer. They are staying poor, they are raising children in poverty, and they are bringing children into poverty because the option not to costs money which they do not have. And it is ironic that the administration, which articulates a strong commitment to family, has in fact had the greatest negative impact on the ability of a family to survive in today's world. The impoverishment of women means that in the last two decades, women-headed families have increased from 36% to 50% of all poor families. There are more than 3.5 million families maintained by women alone whose income is below the poverty level. What choices are we providing them? And we know that the anti-choice movement tries to blame the epidemic of teenage pregnancy on the existence of legal abortion, contraceptives, and sex education, when in fact the opposite is true. Poverty is a real threat to most women, not just the women that we know that are currently impoverished. One half of all marriages end in divorce today, and it is the woman who usually ends up as a single parent. Women are becoming never married parents more often than ever before. Women, of course, we know, earn considerably less money than men, and they are more likely to work in the marginal sectors of the economy. The nation's shift in priority toward defense spending and away from combating poverty has contributed to this situation. But what has all this got to do with abortion? Well, it is vital that society recognize that reproductive health care decisions are made by women in terms of the full context of their lives. And unfortunately, the political climate of this last decade has resulted in actions which have caused basic rights to unravel into wrongs as a backlash against feminism, civil rights, peace, and social and economic justice. It is in this context that women are fighting for the right to be accepted as responsible moral decision makers and for freedom of religion and questions of reproductive health care. And in these times, the admonishment by the pro-life movement to choose life carries a cruel and tragic irony. And women must have the power to choose life. The pro-choice movement must, I think, be led by the same ethic which has marked the movements for social and economic justice in the latter part of the 20th century. The religious tradition that undergirded the civil rights movement, the battle for equality, development, and peace, That same spirit must guide us in the preservation of religious and reproductive freedom. The rights of no one are safe unless the exercise of those rights is guaranteed to everyone. It does us no good to have the right to vote if we cannot actually enter the voting booth. It is of no use to have public policy recognize abortion as a legal option if all of us are denied access to services, because the power to choose life comes hand in hand with the power to transform life into something that can be spiritually and emotionally rewarding, into something worth living. Thank you.
All right. We're going to open it up for a brief question and answer, not too brief, and then we'll go into the film. At what time did you want to start the film, by the way?
Well, I'd like to have a couple of minutes for people to do questions and answers.
Okay. Any questions immediately? I know I had one.
Well, can I just ask that if we can have just 2 minutes for people to look over? I did want to take any the resolutions. There's a place for you to sign up, and I did want to take some back to the convener. So if we would have some time for that. There's a fact sheet that you can just take for information, but there's another sign up that I would like to take back with me.
I think they just put on a front like they were really doing something. And when they would leave the clinic, they'd say, good work, you know, keep going at it, and then drive off. Mm-hmm. We had no assistance from Dallas, which is, well, that whole area is just very conservative. Mm-hmm. And at one time, there was a meeting where some other directors from clinics got together and trying to figure out something to do. And we had a couple of game plans, but nothing really helped. I mean, could you see anything in that situation that would have been more productive?
It is frustrating. You just cited a lot of the common problems that happen when a clinic is subject to this kind of action. Clinics are spread throughout the country, and because right now there is no federal response to this as a conspiracy of terrorism or upholding civil rights laws that are on the books that could be used against anti-abortionists, it is subject to local control, and that's a common problem. We're trying to deal with that. One of the things we have going is it's called Project Affirm. It's a study of the effect of this kind of violence on the people who work in clinics. And we're surveying our members. We're trying to see what sort of resources are out there in the community to help them. We try to sponsor workshops that help them deal with the community on this. We're also, and I brought some brochures if anyone's interested, sponsoring a clinic defense workshop. And it's on going to court, what you can do to try to enforce your rights. Right now, a lot of clinics are going through what your clinic went through. And it's tough. Everybody seems to be afraid to confront picketers. We all want to uphold the First Amendment. Nobody wants to do something to our rights that's going to come back and hit us in the face later. We don't want to stomp on the First Amendment. But we think that there must be ways we can educate local DAs, local policemen, that look, there's lawful picketing and then there's harassment. And how do we draw the line? it's tough. We haven't solved the problem yet. Our clinics are still frustrated, even with the national officers about what to do about it. We're just trying to expose the problem more and more and educate the people more and more about it. It is tough. It sounds like you did what you could. I think as much community support as you can get, even before something happens, women's groups, church groups, other health organizations, so that when something like that happens, you're prepared. I think that's one thing. Were you going to?
I was going to say that as a former resident of the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex, Ms. Gee, the one thing that came to mind when you said that is that it's a very fundamentalist-oriented community, and that cannot be denied. Besides the policemen and you said the courts or whatever, I'm sure the church leaders were very adamant against your clinic, and that cannot be overemphasized how important these church leaders are. Not just church leaders, but they're actually community leaders, and they have a strong organization every Sunday and Wednesday, and it's very much of a Baptist community, and very fundamentalist, Bible Belt oriented, and Dallas is, and Fort Worth for that matter.
The whole area. And I think by the end, we felt like there was nothing we can do. I mean, these people were just so organized, and it was a very complex problem in that the clinic was located in a complex full of other businesses.
Mm-hmm.
And then after a while, they were coming to us like, look, you know, we've got to get together and do something because these pickers are getting heavier and heavier. We don't want to lose our business. And when they bombed, the whole complex was gone. Just boom,
mm-hmm.
kaboom. It was just this big empty space. It was really a terrible thing to happen.
Yeah.
Was anyone prosecuted for that?
I don't believe so. They didn't. They found a little bit of evidence of the what they used, the bomb, but I don't believe so. I don't think they ever found out who it was. And it was just 45 minutes, the last two people had left the clinic,
mm-hmm.
and then they bombed it. And I quit 2 weeks before it was bombed because I kept saying this clinic is going to be bombed. I think it's inevitable.
Mm-hmm.
And it was.
And no one yet has been killed in one of these bombings,
right.
But some people think it's only a matter of time. And last year there was a new trend, which was package bombs that are delivered through the mail.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not something that would go off in an empty building at night. Someone opening the mail would be harmed by that. So it is a very real concern.
You know what I'm thinking about? It's going to be totally off the wall, but I'm sort of thinking about union organizing and how like a national union would get a group of people to go into a site where there's trouble and use their skills in, you know, dealing with those kind of hostile situations. I'm wondering if anything exists like that now, or you've thought about it.
Where you had sort of a national action to do
group
something?
That actually went on site where the problems were happening and helped, you know, these people would have skills in dealing with hostile situations, had dealt with them before, and maybe could provide support, you
mm-hmm.
know, for those clinics that aren't going to want this. I'm wondering if anything exists or if you thought about it. Or
there's a lot that goes on. There's not a national effort. That is a good suggestion, perhaps talking to people in the labor movement about the ways they've dealt with it. Right now, a lot of it depends on the area. I mean, there are clinic escort services, and the National Organization for Women has been very instrumental in helping on that. We try to give as much education as possible to our clinics on security and prevention, but clearly more is needed, and that is a good suggestion. The antis also were very smart in that they are using rhetoric and gains from the civil rights movement and the labor movement against abortion facilities. In other words, they cry First Amendment, and so a lot of civil liberties groups are reluctant to come and speak against what they're doing because we don't want to shoot ourselves in the foot. Some labor groups are reluctant to enforce restrictions on picketing around hospitals because they're afraid it could hurt, you know, labor picketing in another instance. So it's been tough. And right now, our feeling is there's a lot of sympathy toward First Amendment freedoms, but somehow there must be a way we can protect access to health care without stomping on other rights.
One of the things, just to interject here, that now and a couple of other groups are doing is instituting a national conspiracy suit against the leaders of this abortion violence, because we're able to document, and we need help in doing this, that the same group of fanatics go from one area of the country to another. And incite this kind of violence. Well, if they are doing that, and we know that they are, there are statutes, the racketeering statutes, as a matter of fact, that prohibit organized crime traveling through interstate, that we are launching suits against them under the RICO Racketeering Acts. And this has really, we think, will be one of the main ways to shake them up. Because like Klan violence, they only feel secure as long as they get away with it. But at the minute they have to actually serve time in jail or actually pay damages for those kinds of acts, I think it will have a real positive effect on the safety of women in clinics.
And if NOW wins that lawsuit, it's in federal court, so they would get a federal injunction. So anytime some of these people come to town, if they violate this injunction, you can go directly to federal court. So in Texas, you wouldn't be subject to your local elected judge or whatever. You could go into federal court. So that would be wonderful if that happens.
That's what I really mean.
It seems to me that a major resource that we haven't learned how to use is the people who come to the clinic, the patients, because they're the ones who know how valuable the service is. Are there any attempts
of our clinics, you may have known Charlotte Taft in the Dallas area, she's big on organizing people, have tried. Sometimes you have a problem with that in that a lot of the patients are very young. This is a new experience for them. They're filled with a lot of ambivalence. For many women, this is something that happens and they want to go on in their life, and it can be difficult. It doesn't mean that it's impossible. And the antis know this, that our constituency, the people using our services, speaking of NAF members, are not people who are going to be easily organizable and visible and want to go out and have their face spread all over CNN at a hearing and so forth. It's certainly something that we consider. It does have difficulties for us.
My question.
Mm-hmm.
That in order for a woman to be entitled to abortion services,
mm-hmm.
does she then, according to this, have to file a police report that she was raped or that she was
Come that again.
Did in order to mm-hmm. for her to be entitled to abortion services,
mm-hmm.
would she have had to previously file police reports on that account for rape or incest?
If she was what?
For the justice campaign.
But if she wanted to get public funding, if she was a victim? Which that hasn't been available. There's just no funding at all unless you're, if continuing your pregnancy.
No, the question was mm-hmm. if a rape victim comes
oh,
forward,
I'm sorry.
How well documented does the assault have to be? Does she have to have gone through police procedures before they'll
mm-hmm.
recognize the legitimacy of her claim?
If it gets passed.
If it gets passed,
I see what you're saying. I'm not really sure. I guess, what's that? I would say that there'd have to be some type of documentation, you know, for most federal funding. You know how it is to get even AFDC. You have to have, you know, all your receipts in and whatever income you're getting. So I would... A police report would be the base, you know, the basic.
It seems to me that's another, it's like limiting one choice to get another. Like, you have the choice of not finding the police, you know, for whatever reason.
Sure. That seems to me where rape crisis centers can step in and play an effective role because they have been in court cases, successful intermediaries instead of the police. Mm-hmm. They've been accepted, they've been legitimized in terms of expert witnesses and what. And so perhaps women getting involved in the campaign and passing the legislation should come from an anti-rape background so that they know that they can offer protections of victim confidentiality at the same time guide the woman through the process of securing public funding. A police department can't and will not do that, but a rape crisis center can. And so it's very important for center workers to be involved in this whole process, the writing of the language for the bill, the writing of the confidentiality guidelines, the whole nine yards, as well as the eligibility.
I don't think the centers have been, am I wrong, Paul? I don't think the centers have been approached or asked to give input and be a part of the process for, you know, writing the bill or doing any of that. Certainly at our center, we have two people that one is working actively with the Justice Campaign as a volunteer, and one is working with that with the DC Ad Hoc Committee. But I don't, to my knowledge, I don't know that of any centers that have actively been approached and asked for input or asked to be a part of the process of preparing this.
Yeah, at this point, I would say it's just started this summer. Okay, this idea right now, it's been organizing religious leaders, because one thing, leaders of this whole right to life movement, whatever, are religious leaders, and they are very sympathetic, and they have very good public relations. You know, how can you say no to a Catholic bishop? How can you throw him in jail? How can you go against your minister or whatever? Yet they're able to organize. And I guess we're trying to go against that theory that all religious leaders are against abortion and that there's some way to get in there and change the tide somewhat. And so also, they started this summer to convene religious leaders to be out there. That's the main focus of the Justice Campaign. I do welcome, though, any suggestions on to, you know, that's one of the reasons I came today, to further, you know, get people, because I think public policy types, you know, legislators are used to hearing all the time, but that person, even if she's not a victim, but if she's a deliverer of services, has a lot to add to a hearing or anything else on this type of issue. And I think that, you know, as a woman had asked about abortion clients, but just people who are, we continually need to make those linkages between the people who deliver services and the public policy. And many times cases or hearings, people start listening when an actual victim or someone who's right out there is presenting a case. It just seems to be more human. All of a sudden the statistics come together in this.
I think I'll take first crack at that, because I think a lot of that March question was directed towards me. First of all, I think the hardest thing, the participation of women of color at the march was overwhelming. The last time we had a pro-choice march at NOW, we had 7 women of color organizations that participated. This time we had over 56 that participated. So I mean, the growth, and I'm talking about like in a 7-year span, the growth was just tremendous. And it was certainly gratifying to see the large number of women of color who are concerned about this issue. Follow-up is a whole nother question. First of all, people of color communities see this as a non-issue. Even though large numbers of them respond to public opinion polls saying they are pro-choice, large numbers of them know somebody who's either had an abortion or considered an abortion, and certainly large numbers of them acknowledge the problem of teenage pregnancy, is somehow they fall out when it comes to being definitively pro-choice. I mean, it just does not happen. Follow-up is taking the form of education, of catalyzing, education though, to begin with, you know, get people to really understanding what are the issues, the fact that we are talking about having control of your life. Racism erobs you of control of your life. Classism, you know, all kinds of oppression. And to not have reproductive freedom is another form of oppression, and it's another elimination of control. When you can make that connection in an educational context, it works. The other thing, though, is getting people to defecate or relinquish the vessel. They don't really like to take strong